I know that to be true from personal experience, but I also know that to be true, and I'm flash-forwarding a bit as to my experience in the military up until today. In January of 2007, I was asked to be a member of the American Enterprise Institute's Iraq Planning Group as an Iraqi security forces subject matter expert, and I'll explain to you how that came to be in a moment. AEI, as everyone knows, contrived the surge, which the president adopted. While I was there, I briefed about the nature of corruption. I spent the better part of my winter leave in December 2006 working on an op-ed that was published in the New York Times on January 14th. It was called Losing Iraq One Truckload at a Time. And it described the failure of coalition forces to curtail corruption, Iraqi corruption, specifically. I didn't wish to, at that point, since I was on active duty, place the onus on American contractors and generals, because that could be subject to UCMJ for that. But nevertheless, that was a wonderful, if I don't mind saying so, that was a wonderful moment, because just a few days prior to that, I think on January 10th or 12th, the president gave his new way forward strategy, which was a crock of you-know-what. And in it, he mentioned little about corruption. As I saw things through my research, having read extensively reports from the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction, the GAO, the DOD, the DOS, USAID, and being an avid reader of mainstream media and alternative sources of the press, naturally I was obsessed with trying to figure out where the discrepancy was with where the generals were promulgating successes and my understanding of the failures that we were experiencing. In my analysis of the degree to which corruption was being studied by our scholars, our leaders at the highest level, the Iraq Study Group, only in two places, and this is alluded to in the op-ed in the New York Times from January 07, only in two places did they talk about corruption. I mean, they basically played lip service to corruption. And that's probably because when you follow the crumb trail with respect to corruption, Iraqi corruption, it leads to American corruption. And investigating American corruption leads to the negligence, mismanagement, incompetence, dereliction of duty of quite a few generals and colonels who have served and still serve. In that briefing at AEI, I devised with my father, who's been an international economist and a strategist for the better part of his life, what's called the problem tree. And in this problem tree, I won't go into the full explanation of it, but one of the root causes for the instability in Iraq, as you can see from the bottom, is corruption. And if you follow that at your leisure, between corruption and an inadequate strategy leads to other issues, which leads to instability in Iraq, which ultimately leads to coalition forces and Iraqi security forces incapable of stabilizing Iraq and enhancing governing capacity, which in essence means failure. Some of the lies and mistruths perpetrated by the generals, colonels, and diplomats in Iraq for the better part of 5-6 years has been this notion that we have X amount of Iraqi security forces trained and equipped. And as was previously spoken, as is known by all, we have 160,000 troops there now, and we had less just a year ago. We basically a proxy army made up of contractors was developed, contrived by Donald Rumsfeld and the administration, because as I see it in the prelude to the war, it was seemingly unpalatable to the American public to send what Eric Shinseki had deemed what was necessary to accomplish the mission, meaning 300,000 to 500,000 troops. So they dismissed him. He retired, and since consistently incorporating troop numbers, Iraqi security forces troop numbers that are fallacious. As an advisory team leader in Iraq, which was one of my many roles, and again, this goes back to that article from the January New York Times article, 30% to 50% of Iraqi security forces on the payrolls are ghosts. They don't exist. And they don't exist for a number of reasons, because the cronies at the top of the Iraqi government see that as a means of securing considerable sums of money in the forms of salaries of hundreds of thousands of bogus soldiers. And of course, those ghost soldiers and the salaries have undoubtedly gone toward ethnic, tribal, sectarian agendas, which has contributed to the perpetuation of the Civil War. Now, going on from that, in Stuart Bowen, the Special Inspector in General of Iraqi Reconstruction's most recent quarterly report in the January of 2008, he mentions that Maliki has dubbed 2008 the year of reconstruction and anti-corruption. Well, you know, funny thing about that, you know, this is 2008. Also of note within the SIGRS report from January 2008, it reiterates previous reports by SIGR that Parsons and other American contractors, Bechtel, North Star, et cetera, which have been written about extensively in various news mediums, that of $500 million given in U.S. taxpayer dollars given to Parsons for buildings, health, and education sectors, only three of 11 construction projects have been completed, and 141 primary health care centers to the tune of $186 million American taxpayer dollars were not built. Now, they conveniently talk about how security conditions were, you know, made it unfeasible for them to construct these contracts that they were asked to do. But the fact of the matter is that that's a lie. There were Americans on many of these sites, and private contractors, security contractors protecting them. And Parsons and all of these organizations have yet to be held accountable. And that is largely due to the fact that it's against the administration's interest to hold them accountable because they are members of their constituency. I've noticed that I have 2 minutes
left. It's a voice of Louise Maltavon, former U.S. Army captain, who's testifying about military contractors.
Document that I have here. I served at the tactical, operational, and strategic levels in Iraq and at AEI. It's kind of unusual for a junior officer to do, so I was privy to generals, colonels, conferences with Abizaid, Casey, et cetera, et cetera. And where is it? Okay, I have evidence in the way of resolution notes dated 29 November 05 between a meeting between Deputy Commanding General Kevin Bergner, who was the Deputy Commanding General of Task Force Freedom, which was in charge of Mosul and northern Iraq in 2005, between the Deputy Commanding General of CPAT, which is the Civilian Police Assistance Transition Team Iraq, which is a sub-entity of MNSTICI, the Multinational Security Transition Command Iraq, which was headed by Petraeus at the time. And in his notes, in their correspondence, is a segment titled Mosul Warehouse SOP. And these are quotations from the document itself. This is literal. These are literal statements from Bergner to Chuck Taylor or Brigadier General Waters, both of whom were deputy commanding generals of CPAT under General Joseph Phil, who I will also speak of on Sunday in the panel. And here it is, and I know I'm taking a little bit more time. I promise I'll wrap up. The issue that they brought, that General Bergner brought in November of 2005, is, quote, there is no MNSTICI CPAT guidance on how to request, issue, and account for issued Iraqi police equipment. Discussion. Currently, there is no regulation or standard operating procedure pertaining to the issue, receipt, storage of Iraqi police equipment. In addition, there is no guidance on the operation of the LDI warehouse or the responsibilities of Task Force Freedom vis-a-vis the LDI warehouse. The LDI warehouse, I'll let you know, is the acronym for Lee Dynamics International, which has recently come under fire and is being indicted, although I suspect the DOD will try to cover this up as they have so many other things. But they go on to say that Task Force Freedom, Iraqi Security Forces cell, in their Operation Security Forces cell, drafted a basic SOP and provided a copy of this to CPAT and MNSTICI. The recommendations that CPAT, offered recommendations that CPAT issue guidance on the operation of the warehouse, of the LDI warehouse, in order to enhance equipment responsibility at the warehouse, and that CPAT should also provide policy on command supply discipline. The response by CPAT, which was the only priority response in this memorandum, was that they, Task Force Freedom, create a memorandum of understanding between the provincial chief of police, who is an Iraqi, and Task Force Freedom, establishing and outlining the provincial chief of police responsibility to receipt, sign, and account for equipment. In addition, the provincial chief of police must appoint in writing a property book officer, a primary deputy, and an assistant, and that this information should be provided to the Ministry of Interior through Iraqi channels and to MNSTICI through coalition forces channels. In essence, what all of that means is that LDI, who was given billions of American taxpayer dollars to procure store, distribute badly needed supplies to American soldiers to give and support Iraqi police and other Iraqi security forces, was non-existent. There was no SOP. That CPAT had no measure. CPAT, which had the onus of responsibility of ensuring oversight over contractors and the means with which they were purchasing and accounting for Iraqi security forces material purchased by U.S. taxpayer dollars, did not occur. It's outrageous. And all of that leads back to, and in conclusion, all of that leads back to the fact that General Petraeus, okay, who's been purporting, you know, surge success strategies through his massive information operations cell from MNFI headquarters in Iraq, he was in charge of MNSTICI, he was in charge of CPAT, and he failed to implement any systems of accountability for contractors who were given billions of dollars of American taxpayer dollars. And he has not been held accountable, nor has the majority of contractors in Iraq, U.S. contractors in Iraq. And it's outrageous that Congress and the American people have allowed this to go on unchecked.
That's the voice of Luis Multivan, who's testifying today, former U.S. Army captain, served two tours in Iraq, the first officer that we've heard from today.
Antonia Yuhas is an activist, author, and policy analyst. She is a fellow with Oil Change International and a visiting scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies. Her articles and opinion pieces appear regularly in newspapers, magazines, and online outlets, including the International Herald Tribune, New York Times, and Los Angeles Times. She is author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time, and the forthcoming The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. She is also a contributing author to Alternatives to Economic Globalization, A Better World is Possible, and A Game as Old as Empire, The Secret World of Economic Hitmen and the Web of Global Corruption. Antonia, we had a little bit of a late start, and Louise just went a little bit over time, so I know we promised you 25 minutes. That's okay. But I know we promised you 25 minutes, but if you could try and keep it down to 20, that would really help us out.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. I'm going to stand up. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here, and I want to say what an absolute honor it is to be here and to be with you, and how grateful I am to Iraq Veterans Against the War for organizing this incredibly difficult and important and powerful event, so thank you.
Just a little acknowledgement of IDEA's effort to organize Winter Soldier.
To be here, and the purpose of my testimony is to provide support to those brave soldiers who are here, those who are standing up against the war, those who are resisting the war, those who are taking action about and against the war, and to provide testimony that supports that activity and those positions. But also, we were asked, very critically, importantly, by the panel leader to make sure that we bring the lived experiences of Iraqis into this discussion and the impact on the ground of Iraqis. And I'm going to attempt to address both of those things in my testimony, with the point of the testimony being that the United States invasion of Iraq was an illegal act of war. It was unsupported by either international law, U.S. law, the U.S. military code of conduct, nor basic morality. In the execution of the war and the ongoing occupation, moreover, a clear pattern of war crimes and crimes against humanity have and are being committed. Soldiers, therefore, who refuse to fight, who stand up to the war, who speak out and act out against the war, are not only morally right in their response, but legally required to take such measures. They are upholding their obligation to reject illegal orders and to defend the Constitution of the United States. I want to begin with a quick quote from Michael Schur. He was the CIA's former senior lead expert on Al-Qaeda. He quit in protest of the actions taken by the Bush administration and has since written several critical books. I'm going to quote from one of those, Imperial Hubris. "The U.S. invasion of Iraq was not preemption. It was an avaricious, premeditated, unprovoked war against a foe who posed no immediate threat, but whose defeat did offer economic advantages." There are two areas in which I'm going to testify to of the illegality of the war. The first is the war's objective. The war's objective, there are certain areas, and I'm sure many of you could articulate these even better than I can. The international law does substantiate for one country initiating a war against another country. That list does not include seizure of another country's natural resources, nor does it include the hoped-for political, economic, and hegemonic gain that gaining control of those resources would grant a nation. I certainly do not stand as a minority person at this point in stating quite an obvious fact, which is said by far more prestigious people than myself, that the war in Iraq was clearly a war launched and fought for and continued to be fought for oil. I think most famously now, Alan Greenspan, the ultra-libertarian Republican conservative former head of the Federal Reserve, who said in his memoirs, "I'm very saddened to say what everyone in Washington knows, which is that the war in Iraq is about oil." Now, some of you may have seen him retreat from those statements in the press after he made them in his memoir. That is because he was attacked from the right for saying the truth. Read his book. Actually, don't. It's 500 pages long. I read it. You don't need to read it. In the chapter in which he makes this statement, it is very clear that what he is saying is intended to be said. It was for him a statement of a no-brainer. It is obvious that this war is about oil. And oil, though, is not just about corporations. It's not just about the corporations who are pillaging, the corporations who are reaping profits. Oil is not just about the corporations who take hold of the oil. Oil is also about the power that having that oil grants to the holdee. The country and the people that control the oil deny it to others who want it. They dictate terms on which it can be acquired. They gain the denial of that oil and the power that could be granted to the other people who want to hold on to that oil. And it grants regional and global power to those who control the oil, which is something that the Bush administration was very frank in its intent, well before taking office, in the intent of the war. The other side of the illegality of the war is the conduct of the war. And the testimony that we've heard so far from Kelly and Luis about the contractors, the manipulation of contractors, this was not a haphazard. This was not something that just happened because of bad oversight or bad planning. The decision to turn the war over to U.S. corporations was part of the very extensive pre-planning for post-invasion Iraq, which did happen quite clearly as part of this war and this war planning. The Bush administration had very clear post-invasion plans. They were laid out, they were well articulated, and they have been followed. Those plans included the complete economic restructuring of the Iraqi economy to allow U.S. corporations in. And if I had time, I would quote from the companies, but I don't. The company's clear stated intent to, one, stay put in Iraq because they saw it as a potential economic boom, and two, to see Iraq as a jumping off point from which they would gain access to the rest of the Middle East. And they state that quite clearly in their intentions. The Bush administration wrote out an economic plan that was then put in place. Now, why this plan was illegal and why it constitutes a crime against humanity is that the U.S. occupation of Iraq, the formal occupation, which was acknowledged by the United Nations as a formal occupation, required certain commitments of the United States. Those commitments were that the United States would ensure that the basic services necessary for life in Iraq would be provided to Iraqi citizens, but it would be excluded from rewriting the basic laws of the nation. The Bush administration did exactly the opposite. It did not provide services, and it did completely rewrite the economic laws. Now, the impact of not providing the services, and I'll try and go into the details of that, are that today, while there are 2.2 million Iraqi refugees who have fled Iraq, 2.2 million who have left the country. That doesn't include the displaced. The United Nations actually does not suggest that those Iraqis return to Iraq. It suggests that they stay away. And the reason why it suggests that they stay away is not security. It's because there is no water, there is no electricity, there is no health care, there is no shelter, there are no roads. And it is not a safe place for Iraqis to be. And that does not just make it unsafe for Iraqis. So just a few days ago, in responding to a question about
we
what
interrupt
will happen
this testimony
if progress is not made
about military
on improving
contractors,
the quality of life
to let
for
you know
Iraqis,
that if you're just tuning in, you're
Major
listening
General
to Pacifica
Mark
Radio's
Erling,
live
Commander
broadcast of
Northern
Winter Soldier,
Iraq,
Iraq and Afghanistan, 2008, live from the National Labor College outside Washington, D.C.
To reduce the number of forces, because there's going to be more people out there planting bombs and shooting people. Now, $50 billion in money was paid out to U.S. corporations, promised to U.S. corporations. It's important that it hasn't all been paid out to do this work. The corporations that have received the most money are the Bechtel Corporation. Yes, Bechtel deserves a hiss, whoever did that. The Bechtel Corporation, Shaw, Perini, the list goes on and on. There's 10 key U.S. contractors. Parsons, Halliburton received the largest money. They have been promised about $20 billion, which is, of course, an enormous sum. The rest of the sums look minuscule in comparison. Bechtel's is about $2.8 billion. Parsons is about $3.5. I'm not going to remember all these numbers. That money is of course, an enormous quantity of money. The problem was that when these grants were given, first of all, Iraqis were, of course, overlooked. But not only were Iraqis overlooked, the entire structure of the economic reconstruction laid in place the results that we're seeing now. So one of the first acts of the U.S. occupation government, led by Paul Bremer, was called the debathification order. This was the order by which Bremer fired 120,000 of all of the key ministerial leaders in Iraq, all of the engineers, all of the scientists, all of the people who ran the water ministry, the electrical ministry, the oil ministry. He fired them all. 120,000 people. He fired them all because he didn't want anyone standing away in the way of the restructuring that was being planned. That left an enormous brain vacuum. The next step that Bremer did was then to fire 500,000 Iraqi soldiers. Wait, yes, 500,000 Iraqi soldiers. The U.S. military had intended that those soldiers would be put to work to do the reconstruction, but the Bush administration's economic plan didn't include that. The Bush administration's economic plan was to bring in private contractors. So immediately from the get-go, you had 500,000 men with guns, made unemployed, without jobs, without money, and their families left without hope, without money. And some estimates put that number at 2.5 million Iraqis, 10% of the population, who from the get-go were now very, very hostile to the reconstruction and to the invasion, to the occupation. All of these people also knew that U.S. companies were being given billions of dollars to reconstruct the country. And you'll hear many people testify to the fact that there are many Iraqis who, while they were very upset that Iraqi companies, of which there were many, Iraqi workers, of which there were many, who were more than capable of doing the work, were being jumped over. But there was a sense that, well, if America is going to spend $10 billion fixing our electricity, that's not so bad, and, you know, maybe that'll be good. And there was a sense of allowing this to take place. The reconstruction failed, and one of the primary reasons why it failed was that the objective was not to just get the services up and running. The objective was this longer-term permanent presence, which I mentioned, so that you had companies like Bechtel spending the first 6 weeks in country walking around doing an assessment of the situation. They could have talked to the Iraqis who ran the water systems. They could have hired the Iraqis to run the water systems, but they didn't. They walked around, they checked out the scene. In that time, there was no electricity. There was no water being provided. And that built up, of course, bad will. And then by the time Bechtel got to work, it became very unsafe for Bechtel to be at work. The failure of the Reconstruction continues, but one of the things that's important for us to remain aware of today is that many of the companies that have radically failed, so Bechtel, a recent report found that they completed less than half of the projects that they were contracted to fulfill, and that was water, electricity, schools, basic rebuilding. Parsons, another analysis just done, that Parsons had barely fulfilled any of its commitments. Of the statistic that Luis gave, Parsons was hired to rebuild 150 primary health centers across the country. They built 34, and not all of them are even functional. But not all of that money has been paid out, and that's an area where we can take action. I just don't nearly have time to say the things that I had planned to say, so let me just say a couple things. The first is the intention of the war to be about oil. Right now, we are in a situation where five oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, BP, Shell, and Total, have just signed, within the last week, contracts to get oil to go into Iraq. Anyone with any sense of Iraqi history recognizes the names of these companies. These are the exact same companies that, from the end of World War II until 1970, owned all of Iraq's oil. They were given it as a war bounty at the end of World War I. They owned it, they controlled it, and they controlled Iraq's fate because of owning the oil. Since they were kicked out in the early 1970s, they've been trying to get back in. This is the second or third and maybe the largest pot of oil in the world, depending on who's counting. The world is running out of oil. However, oil sells for $110 a barrel. This oil is sitting there like a gleaming prize at the end of the finishing line. And believe me, they have been planning and plotting to get it. These five contracts are the tip of the iceberg. The intent is to get the Iraqis to pass a law that would put everything back the way it was in the 20s. To take it from a nationalized oil system to a privatized oil system, where U.S. oil companies, and a little bit for the French and a little bit for the British, because, you know, we like them, would own and control the oil. Now, if that happens, a U.S. government report that was leaked by ABC News said that, and just so we are using the terminology, this is one of the president's benchmarks for Iraq, which the Congress adopted, passage of an oil law in Iraq. Another one of the benchmarks, by the way, was reversing the debathification law that Bremer put into place that fired all of those experts. The oil law, if it is to be put in place, and if U.S. companies and the companies that are angling are Exxon, Chevron, Conoco, Marathon, BP, Shell, and Total, if they stay, they will need to be, quote, underwritten by the U.S. government. I take underwritten not by the U.S. government to mean you, to be underwritten by the U.S. military, that we will have to stay to ensure their safety and the continuation of their mission, which was the whole reason why we went there in the first place. Now, I'm supposed to wrap up. Let me say two things on hopefulness, because there was a lot of talk last night about where is the U.S. peace movement. In the last several months, and this is a reflection of the last several months and of the last several years, press coverage of Iraq has fallen precipitously, such that where it was 15% of coverage last year, it was 1% of mainstream media coverage in the last period of time that was measured. 1%. The average American at this point thinks that only 3,000 U.S. soldiers have died in Iraq. They don't know what's happening in Iraq. But we also don't know, unless we are listening and watching Democracy Now!, listening and watching KPFA, listening and watching Truth Out!, that the peace movement is, in fact, alive and well and active. You just can't pick up your newspaper to see it. So, for example, to address the problems that we're talking about right now, the corporate pillaging, this Saturday in San Francisco and in Richmond, California, activists are going to be shutting down Chevron's refinery, where it's bringing in Iraqi oil, and they're going to shut it down for a day so that Chevron can't profit off of its Iraqi oil for one day. And they're going to surround the refinery by water, by land, by bike, We've shut down Chevron's headquarters. We've shut down Bechtel's headquarters such that Bechtel got so sick of being shut down every week in San Francisco that after 100 years of being based in San Francisco, they left town. And they have not... They have not re-upped after their deep commitment. They wanted to privatize Iraq's water. They wanted to privatize Iraq's electricity. They wanted to stay there. They have not re-upped their contracts. They have not stayed because it was not in their interest to do so. The answer to all of this is, one, that there is activism and there needs to be more. Two, not that the U.S. soldiers have to stay in Iraq to make sure that reconstruction happens. That's not what I'm saying. That Iraqis are more than capable of doing this work and having this money turned over, and that the most important thing is for the occupation to end, and all of the occupation to end, all of the contractors to leave, all of the companies to leave, all of the soldiers to leave, so that Iraqis can pick up the pieces for themselves. Thank you all very, very much.
And you are listening to Pacifica's live coverage of the Winter Soldier 2008. Here in Silver Springs, Maryland, we're listening to a panel about corporate corruption in the occupation of Iraq. The person who you just heard speak is Antonia Juhasz. She is author of the book Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time.
The rise of the world's most powerful mercenary army. He is an award-winning investigative journalist and correspondent for the national radio and TV program Democracy Now! He is also a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute.
Well, thank you all. Is this fine, the microphone? I talk loud in general, so.
Yeah,
closer, you think? Sorry about that. Luis and I have the same issue, I guess. I first want to say
it's contractor problems.
Contractor problems, yes. Blackwater provided the security for the microphones today. When I've been running around the country over the past year talking about Blackwater, I've been approached numerous times by people who sort of say, are you afraid that somebody's going to bump you off, because these guys are, tough guys with guns and stuff. And I've started saying to people when they ask, do you have any protection? I say that my protection is the fact that IVAW is standing against the war. Because with all this talk lately of that 3 a.m. phone call, the members of IVAW understand that the only way we can ensure peace in this world is to have people in office who make it so that 3 a.m. phone calls don't happen. I also want to say I'm incredibly humbled to be here among you and to have been invited to come and join you today. I also want to thank personally the members of IVAW, and I've had a chance to meet many of you over the course of my travels. For being so clear on something that even sectors of the peace movement have been unable to be clear on, and that is that there needs to be an unconditional, immediate withdrawal from Iraq and a payment of reparations to the Iraqi people. The logic of you broke it, you bought it has a lot of flaws as it's floated by Democratic legislators and some people even identifying themselves as anti-war. What we have is a situation where you stab someone repeatedly over the course of an hour, you leave their body there to die, and then you approach them, you dip a Band-Aid in poison and stick it on them, and you say, things are getting better, this person's going to be cured. That's where what the break-it, bought-it logic leads to. The reality is that as long as there is 10 or 20 U.S. soldiers in Iraq as an occupation force, there will be the incredible violence suffered by the Iraqi people that we see right now. It will continue to be flypaper for those who want to attack U.S. soldiers. It will continue to give Iran a much greater hand in Iraq. There are very mainstream, to use their phrase, reasons why the United States should not be in Iraq right now. But that's not the focus of what I want to talk to you about today. I've been investigating Blackwater for several years now, and I want to tell you a couple of stories from the recent investigations that I've been doing, not so much focus on what I've been talking about over the past year. And I want to begin with an incident that I'm sure many of you are familiar with. It happened on the afternoon of September 16th, 2007, in Baghdad's Nisr Square. A young Iraqi medical student named Haitham al-Rubai. He was 20 years old, was driving his mother, who also was a doctor. They had just dropped off their father, his father, himself a doctor. Medicine was in his DNA. They got into the square that day. They were going to be running some errands, dropping off college applications for his sister. And when they pulled into the square, at the same time that they arrived, a convoy of vehicles approached, going the wrong way on a one-way street. I'm sure this story sounds familiar to soldiers who were in Iraq. These vehicles, which were reportedly South African Mamba armored vehicles, entered Nisr Square. They drove the wrong way down a one-way road. Iraqi police scrambled to cut off traffic, as they often have to do, not for the protection of the armored vehicles, but for the protection of Iraqi civilians who may have the lethal misfortune of getting too close to these vehicles. One car was unable to stop quick enough, and one of the gunmen atop the South African Mamba armored vehicle shot a bullet right through the head of the 20-year-old medical student. His car came to a semi-stop, but it was an automatic transmission car, and it kept rolling a bit toward the armored vehicles. His mother was clutching her son's bloodied body. Iraqi policemen ran over to her, and they heard her yelling, "My son, my son," and they tried to pull the woman from the car and to stop the vehicle. They saw men in the other armored vehicles aiming their weapons at the vehicle. The Iraqi policemen were yelling at them not to shoot, that they were civilians in the car. And then the men inside of the armored vehicles continued to light up that vehicle, and they blew up the car with the mother inside holding her dead son's body. They launched some kind of projectile at the vehicle, and it engulfed it in flames, and the mother and her son were melded together, their flesh melted into one another. That was the beginning of a 15-minute shooting spree during which 17 Iraqi civilians, among them very young children and women, were killed. Several of the Iraqi victims, all of them civilians, were shot as they were running away from the scene or as they sat trapped in their vehicles. The shooters that day in the square were not U.S. soldiers, at least not on active duty, nor were they Iraqi insurgents. They were heavily armed mercenaries who worked for Blackwater USA, recently renamed Blackwater Worldwide. In the aftermath of that 15-minute shooting spree, the Iraqi government was under the mistaken impression that it was sovereign and ordered Blackwater to leave the country. For 3 days, Blackwater stopped escorting U.S. officials in and out of the Green Zone. Their operations were shut down. And what that meant was that the Green Zone was turned into the Green Zoo. Not a single U.S. occupation official that was non-military was able to leave the Green Zone because Blackwater was not guarding them. So central had that force become to U.S. occupation activities. And an indication of how important Blackwater was to the White House at the time, when Condoleezza Rice called Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki ostensibly to apologize, she made it clear to him Blackwater would be going nowhere. The Iraqi government interviewed witnesses, and they issued their repeated demand that Blackwater leave, and then they said that they intended to prosecute the killers as murderers in Iraqi courts. Now, well, hold on a second. If we lived in a just world, and if there was a sovereign Iraqi government, these individuals would have been handed over to the Iraqi courts. But as you all well know, one of Paul Bremer's last acts, the day before he skulked out of Baghdad in June of 2004, was to issue an edict known as Order 17, which granted a sweeping immunity to all contractors from prosecution in Iraqi courts. And he did this at a time when the U.S. was saying they were handing over sovereignty to the Iraqi governments. It's a strange definition of sovereignty to defang a country's legal system or judicial system or court system while at the same time saying, here's your sovereignty. What we saw in the aftermath of Nisr Square was pushback from the White House. Within 3 days, Blackwater was back on the streets of Iraq, armed and dangerous. They remain there to this moment. Their contract is up for automatic renewal in May. Unless someone makes the decision to cancel it, it will be automatically renewed. The State Department began a cover-up of those killings and an attempt to immunize the individual shooters from prosecution on orders from the Bush administration, from the highest levels of power in Washington. I don't have a tremendous amount of time, so I'm going to streamline some of what I was going to talk about with this cover-up. The State Department offered the individuals who did the shooting that day from Blackwater in the Square something called limited use immunity, which is very rarely handed out before you figure out who the guilty parties are. And basically what it said was, you talk to us and nothing you say can or will be used against you in a court of law. That was one of the ways Oliver North got off after Iran-Contra, was because he had been given this immunity. And then later, his lawyers argued that prosecutors used that information he provided with his immunity to bring charges against him, and that's how he got off the hook. So the State Department, within hours of this shooting, offers the shooters that limited use immunity. And what that means now is that the FBI, as it investigates it, cannot use any of that information that these individuals gave to bring any charges against them. Now, if you have any faith in the Bush Justice Department's ability or willingness to prosecute politically connected corporations, you probably weren't invited here, and I look forward to your disruption in a few moments. But what we saw was that you have a crime scene where you have 17 civilians that were gunned down, apparently in cold blood, with no provocation whatsoever. The chief law enforcement entity of the United States government is the FBI. They were not sent in to investigate for a full 2 weeks. While that crime scene was contaminated, while witnesses were not taken in for questioning, while the individuals had been granted some form of an immunity. And in fact, when the FBI finally got around to being sent over there, it emerged that Blackwater was actually going to be guarding the investigators for the FBI until Senator Patrick Leahy stood up and said, "This is insane. The accused killers and their friends are going to be guarding the investigators?" You see, that this is the reality. You know who guards Nancy Pelosi when she goes over to Iraq? Blackwater. How on earth are we going to have an aggressive congressional investigation against these guys when congresspeople go over there and depend on them to stay alive? That's how deep this has cut. But something interesting happened. The Iraqi government did an investigation that was maligned left and right in the press. The corrupt, and I concur with what Luis was saying, the corrupt Iraqi Interior Ministry. And I think there's a lot of reason to be suspicious of what the Iraqi Interior Ministry says. But in this case, what the Iraqis accused Blackwater of doing was corroborated not by the State Department, who employs Blackwater and depends on its mercenaries to keep its forces alive, not by the Bush White House, but by the U.S. military. The Army sent investigators there almost immediately. In fact, they were there within 12 minutes of the first death that happened in the square that day. They investigated it. And what the U.S. military determined, and this got almost no publicity whatsoever except for one story in the Washington Post, is that all 17 of those Iraqis were killed as a result of unjustified and unprovoked fire, and they said that it was criminal conduct. That was the military investigation. When the FBI... And what the military did, what the Bush White House and its State Department should have done immediately, they interviewed Iraqi witnesses. They interviewed Iraqi police officers on the scene. They interviewed people who themselves had been shot. They interviewed some of the individuals who had taken part in the melee that day. We also discovered that apparently one Blackwater officer was so horrified, Blackwater mercenary was so horrified at what was happening, that he turned his own weapon on another Blackwater guy and told him to cease fire. That's how out of control it had gotten. So the military does its investigation. The FBI finally gets over there. And I was very skeptical of what the FBI was going to find. But what was incredible is that the FBI leaked some of its findings to the New York Times. And we understand that the FBI says that 14 of those 17 deaths were as a result of unjustified and unprovoked fire. The military, in return, said that the FBI was being too generous to Blackwater. And so what happens now? Where are the individuals who gunned down these 17 people? They're walking around as free people. They'll never be handed over to the Iraqi legal system, and they may never be prosecuted in this country, because the laws on the books right now in the United States are such that if you're a soldier and you murder someone in Iraq, you could be court-martialed, clear as could be. There have been at least 64 murder-related courts-martial in Iraq. I think the number is probably much greater now, which I think is shockingly low. I think that there's been a lot more murder in Iraq by U.S. soldiers, and it needs to be prosecuted. Not a single armed contractor has ever been prosecuted for any crimes in Iraq whatsoever. Not jaywalking, not murder, not torture. Only two contractors of the hundreds of thousands that have gone in and out of there over the course of 5 years have ever been charged with any crime. One of them was an individual who pled guilty to possession of child pornography images on his computer at Abu Ghraib prison. How about the contractors who participated in the torture at Abu Ghraib prison? This guy goes down for having porno images on his computer, a moral crime in the eyes of the Bush administration. And then you have another prosecution of an individual who allegedly stabbed a coworker in a kitchen, a KBR person. That represents the entirety of prosecution of the private army that the Bush administration has deployed in Iraq. Blackwater is not the biggest of these companies. It's not even the most profitable. It's sort of like a high-end boutique on a strip full of Walmarts. It's the Maserati of the industry. But right now in Iraq, as Luis said, you have somewhere between 150 and 160,000 U.S. soldiers who wear the United States flag. You have 182,000 private contractors, and that doesn't even count the armed ones. They work for 630 corporations on the U.S. government payroll. They draw personnel from 100 countries around the world. In addition to that, you have 170 mercenary firms operating in Iraq. I want to repeat that. There are 170 companies that provide services like Blackwater's in Iraq right now. That's almost as many nations as there are registered at the UN. What does that say about the discussion that we, all of us, I think, have about Iraq being a model? You know, the role of the U.S. military in Iraq, one of the main roles that the U.S. military has played in Iraq has been to ensure that U.S. war corporations make a killing off of that war. And KBR provides poison water to the troops. They don't even take care of the people that they're using to make their killing in Iraq. And you know, Blackwater has taken in $1 billion in security contracts just in Iraq. That doesn't count their work in Afghanistan or the 50,000 U.S. personnel they train a year at their private military base in Moyock, North Carolina. This has not just been about looting Iraq or taking Iraq's oil. It's also about looting the U.S. Treasury. It's about undermining U.S. democratic processes. Why has the Bush administration elected to use this army of private contractors? Others on this panel have alluded to it, but I think it boils down to a couple of very basic reasons. This administration does not want to implement a draft because it would make the Iraq war politically untenable very, very fast. They don't want to deal with the messy process of parliamentary democracies in countries around the world whose citizens are opposed to the Iraq invasion in order to coerce or co-opt them into participation in the occupation, or in that case, the invasion of Iraq. And so what they've done is they have rented an army. They've built a coalition, not of the willing, but of the billing, to go in and occupy Iraq. This is a subversion of the not only will of the American people now, who are pretty clearly against this war, the will of the Iraqi people, over 70% of whom want an immediate end to the occupation, but it's a subversion of the sovereignty of the nations of those 100 countries around the world who have personnel deployed working for this rented army in Iraq. I understand I have to wrap up here. I got to about a fraction of what I wanted to say, but I want to wrap up by talking about something that I think is of crucial importance right now, and that is looking at the election campaign in the context of what's happening right now in Iraq. The role of people who want an end to the war in Iraq, an end to the occupation of Iraq, is not to drink the Kool-Aid of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's live coverage of Winter Soldier. The speaker is Jeremy Scahill.
Wants U.S. troops to be in Iraq until they're all as old as he is. But we have something that's deadly serious right now, and I think that so many people are wrapped up in the fainting spells and the mesmerizing state of mind that we all are familiar with now, that they forget a million Iraqis have died. since the beginning of this war that wouldn't have otherwise died as a beginning of the occupation. It's a consistent U.S. policy. And the reality is, and I've been investigating this recently, neither Barack Obama nor Hillary Clinton have any intention of ending the occupation of Iraq. They both have plans to keep anywhere between 40 and 80,000 troops in Iraq. That's not to count the contractors who operate now at a more than one-to-one ratio. And they say they're going to keep the green zone in place, the Baghdad airport, the U.S. Embassy, which is the largest in world history. Anyone who is in the military, and I think we have a lot in this room right now, knows that those things don't exist in a vacuum. You have to run supply lines. You have to have cargo planes coming in. You have to have your forces protected. You have to have your forces supplied. So we're talking about potentially 120,000 to 150,000 U.S.-paid personnel remaining in Iraq under a plan that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton say is a plan to end the war or end the occupation. And I'm not here to say to you, don't vote for these people, or you should go vote for someone else. What I'm here to say on this issue is that the individuals in this room who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have a unique credibility that I don't have in talking about this. And perhaps the most important thing we could do right now, and I think it's a good thing that Hillary Clinton is still in the race, because then it's not just a giveaway. We have a moment where pressure can be applied. And I think it's so important to push them now, not in November, not wishful thinking that something good's going to happen down the line, but to get them to back off of their continuation occupation plans, back away from it, and support immediate, unconditional withdrawal. The last thing I'm going to say is this. If there's one thing that the Democrats have shown themselves capable of doing, it's losing very important elections and then blowing it once they've won. The Congress under Nancy Pelosi has been shameful on the issue of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. The fact that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both want to put more troops in Afghanistan, want to increase the size of the military by 90,000 troops, speaks volumes to the state of politics right now. Ending a war of this magnitude can be done very quickly if it's the number one international priority of those in power. And we need to realize that we are not defined in times where we like somebody that's running for office. In fact, this is probably the most important moment in our lives when it comes to what is the direction of our country going to be. And we should never, and this is it for me, this is what I'm going to say, we should never, ever cede our conscience to those in power because we think that lesser of two evils is somehow just. It is so dire, the stakes that we have right now in the world. And all of you who were veterans and were in Iraq and in Afghanistan are the leaders of a movement that is going to continue to grow. And it is you who are going to change the face of this nation, who are going to stand up for those who have been victimized in Iraq, and those who are going to put this country on a path toward reconciliation and a just policy. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel on corporate pillaging and military contractors, part of 3 days of testimony at the Winter Soldier Iraq and Afghanistan Tribunal held in Silver Spring, Maryland in March 2008. The event was organized by the Iraq Veterans Against the War, the IVAW. Please visit their website, ivaw.org, for a complete record of the event and to find out how to become a part of the growing GI resistance movement. We'll continue with more testimony next week.